You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks.
You are listening to New Mexico Filmworks, brought to you by Hutton Broadcasting, and this is being broadcast on Talk 1260 KTRC. My name is Dirk Norris, filling in for Toby Ives this morning while she attends to other film duties, and came up from South Central New Mexico. I live in a little place called Oscuro. So little, as a matter of fact, that when I moved there with my three dogs, we doubled the population. and a beautiful drive up this morning. Later in the show, we're going to be talking with Don Gray, who is the Film Office Locations Coordinator, and John Armijo, who is the film historian, among other duties. But right now and in the studio, I have with us the director of the UNM Arts Lab and faculty member of the Interdisciplinary Film and Digital Media Program, Tim Castillo. Tim.
Hello.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me today.
So before we get into the depths of all of that, why don't you give us a little background and where you're from and how you got to be to UNM?
Sure. I actually grew up in New Mexico. I grew up in Silver City, and I started in architecture. And I'm actually still a faculty member in the architecture program. But I kind of had a longer route road. I ended up going to graduate school at Columbia University in New York City. And then came back, I started in academia and started teaching at University of Arizona, University of Colorado, and finally had an opportunity to come back to the University of New Mexico. And it's been a great road back. It's great to be back at UNM. I really enjoy working with the students, the students of New Mexico.
And you've been at the university for how long?
For 9 years now, going on 10, yeah.
Right. Have you been there since the inception of the program?
I have. I was very involved early on. It's a very unique program in that we're an interdisciplinary program. So I was working with the director, the founding director, who was a computer science professor, Ed Angel. And he really cultivated a group of faculty members, and we were sort of the driving force to getting the film and digital media program established, but also the arts lab.
I come from an American studies background, and when I tell people it's an interdisciplinary approach to the study of American culture, inevitably the response is, huh?
Yeah.
So if you would tell us, what is the interdisciplinary film and digital media program?
Sure. Interdisciplinary. We work with various colleges and schools, and so like I said, I'm from the architecture department, but we work with computer science and electrical computing engineering faculty in the College of Engineering, and we also work with faculty from fine arts, the Anderson School of Management, and arts and science. And so we're a very unique program in the landscape of digital media. And so there's very few programs that have this sort of interdisciplinary connection within the United States.
So if somebody wanted to get into film financing or the business aspect of Anderson School of Business is there and offers the courses to accommodate
exactly,
that.
Exactly. We have a whole curriculum dedicated to allowing those classes to be instructed. And Nick Floor, the previous film and digital media director, has been very involved in that, and he sort of drives that part of the program.
And the students are part of the design process of the courses that they take?
They are. In fact, I teach the introduction course, and my role in the program is really to get the students to think innovatively and creatively. So I, introduce a lot of the technologies, from gaming to interactive media to digital modeling, and really get them to think about it in an innovative way, so that they're really becoming critical thinkers and really trying to define a path where they can be successful in whatever they choose to do.
Okay. And the Arts Lab is one aspect of IFDM.
Mm-hmm.
And ARTS is also an acronym.
It is. It stands for Art, Research, Technology, and Science. And it's sort of the research arm of the digital media program at UNM. And so what we try to do is really spawn innovation and really look at technologies that are going to create a different way of looking at the world. And so primarily one of the things that we're really interested in is the immersive technologies. And what that means is that it's a world where you start to break down the sort of two-dimensionality of the traditional cinematic experience and really start to look at things that become much more engaging in a way where all your senses are starting to be tapped into.
I have been curious about digital video mapping. Do you guys do some of that?
We do, and I think that is that more like what you would see in Google Earth or something?
Well, projecting images on buildings.
Oh yeah, definitely. One of the things that we have been working on, we received a National Science Foundation grant a couple years, and we're just completing the research right now. And one of the things that Professor Dr. Joe Niss was working on was what we call sort of unfolding of that immersive experience. And so we're looking at multi-projection systems and being able to, project on any surface and being able to create that that immersive experience that that you probably don't get in a traditional setting.
So that includes like dome projection?
Exactly. Yeah, the dome, we're one of the few institutions, within the U.S. that has a dome research lab. And so that's primarily a lot of the research that we do. And what we try to do is get the professors from different departments to come in and be part of that experience and really look at the dome in an innovative way.
And the IAIA also has a dome projection facility or a program.
Exactly.
How are they similar? Are they different?
The one at IAIA is larger than ours, and I think it's 24 feet in diameter. Ours is 15, but it's pretty much a same experience. Theirs tilts 90 degrees, and so our associate director for immersive media, David Bining, was a consultant with IAIA, and so we have a lot of cross collaboration right now. We got a Department of Defense grant that we're working on with them that'll be happening this next year, and we're looking at sort of unique experiences that emerge out of the Native American culture and really how those things can really determine a different spatial environment.
Yeah, we were talking earlier, and you said you were really developing this relationship and kind of exploring that aspect and a different way of looking at the world.
Exactly. I teaching architecture, I found that working with Native American students that there's a very different sensibility of space, and I think it's very unique and something that maybe a lot of people haven't really done a lot of research in. And so, really looking at it through the lens of through digital media, I think offers some unique experiences. So we're really excited about how this research will unfold.
And is that where your background in architecture is an asset for?
It is. I believe so. I think that kind of the way that I approach design has always been sort of interdisciplinary, and I think that having a background in environments and how the world's constructed allows me a perspective that is unique, I think, to that educational experience.
Do you so the kids that are kind of interested in architecture, do you favor them? No.
Oh, I don't know. I would say maybe yes.
Yeah. And how many students in the program?
I think we're up to 140. And okay. So we're a relatively young program, but we've increased our enrollment every year. And so this last class that I taught in the fall was a class of about 70. So I think we're going to be about the same or maybe even a little bit more this incoming class.
And how does the university or does your program get out there and advertise it? How do people find out about it?
Well, we do a lot of promotion via the web. We do a lot of that. And then a lot of exposure through, our professors and the work that they do. And so, we try to get out to the high schools too. We have a promotional package that goes out with a lot of the recruiters, and they try to sell IFDM. And we've just seen our enrollment. I think one of the things that's been really attractive as of late is that we've become one of the top 10 gaming institutions in the country. And that's really in part due to Professor Pradeep Sun. His affiliation is in electrical computing engineering, and he's just really developed that into a realm that it really promotes us in a way that is very unique.
That's become a really big deal for the university and being in the top 10 awardee.
Exactly. It's a great notch in our belt, and I think that we just want to continually support that program that Pradeep's is instituted. And I think that, you know, with where the kids are in terms of gaming, it makes a lot of sense. And we've just become a leader in that trajectory.
And we were also talking about how people are consuming media in a different way, and that kind of plays into that, and
exactly.
and tapping into all of that.
Exactly. It's just ubiquitous in terms of how technology has become part of the way that we live. And it's interesting, when you look at mobile devices like iPads or, iPhones and all those, technologies that are emerging. I think that it gives us tremendous potential in developing that kind of technology into something that's unique.
I heard an author, writer, maybe it was on Facebook, say he likes going to the movies, but his son, he doesn't go to the theater. He consumes media on his iPad or a smartphone or something like that.
Exactly. And I think that, it's very different. I have a 7-year-old, and the way he engages technology is very different. And so we are, we're just going to constantly see this evolution occur. And it's it's exciting for us. We really want to be a leader in terms of developing it, students that will lead that conversation in the future.
You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC, and we'll be back in just a minute with Tim Castillo. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC. And in the studio here, we have Tim Castillo. He's the director of the UNM Arts Lab and faculty member of the IFDM, Interdisciplinary Film and Digital Media Program. And this is something that's been hitting me a little bit, too, is the use of the word film. Is anybody actually using film? I think it's becoming a legacy term.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of people that still are interested in traditional film, but it really is digital media now. And I think that that's kind of our perspective within the program, is really trying to be as global as we can in terms of having our students understand that it's a changing field. It has to be something that is innovative and moving in a direction where they'll be able to support themselves in the future.
I've always thought of New Mexico as being kind of a state that's on the cutting edge of technology and, mm-hmm. and kind of looking down the road. That must be a difficult thing for you in this program to kind of anticipate and stay with.
Yeah, it's something that's moving very quickly, and I think that the challenges with it is there's so much research being done globally that you, in order to be relevant, you have to be quick about the way you're pursuing the research. And I think, for us, we tend to think of ourselves as leading the conversation in many different emerging fields. And I think that, we want to continually do that, but it is a challenge that is difficult to stay out in front of.
Are the students part of that conversation, keeping up with, because it's, as these technologies come along, it's always the younger people that just latch right onto them, and the rest of us are playing catch up, sort of.
Well, it is, and what we try to do is allow the research to lead the conversation and allow that to, be disseminated into the curriculum. And so what we try to do is, as the emerging research starts to come out, we try to get our graduate students, our undergraduate students to be part of that. And hopefully what we're doing is planting the seed, because what we want our students to do is get out there into the community and start to develop these technologies, because we want to foster that growth within the state.
Right. I mean, it's all about job creation and business creation. And so what are the opportunities that exist right now in the state of New Mexico for digital media?
It's kind of emerging as we go along. I think that what we try to do, and this is kind of an ongoing conversation with the faculty, is that what kind of student are we trying to prepare? And I think one of the kind of hitting notes is that we want to create a student that has the ability to define his path regardless of the economy. And so what that means is that they have to be entrepreneurial. And that's really where it's going, is that the more successful students are the ones that are able to migrate from one technology to another. And so we've seen some various success cases already of people that are doing that. You know, people that are doing interactive media, touchscreen technologies, you name it, they're out there doing that.
The touchscreen technologies, there's an outfit in Corrales that has touchscreen work tables.
Exactly.
Is that are those folks from the program?
They have had conversations with us, and we tend to bring people into our lectures, and they talk about the technologies. But those are some of the things that that we like to incorporate. But I think our students are already approaching levels where they're maybe even pushing their edge. So that's exciting to see.
And I imagine you're getting a fair amount of support from the community, different groups coming in and teaching and being advisors.
Exactly. We had tremendous support from Sony ImageWorks. They've been in Albuquerque in the last 3 years, and they've been a tremendous asset to our program. Their global connections and the expertise that they bring to the program has just been inspiring to a lot of the faculty. So we're just happy to have that affiliation.
There was a video, I think Sony did it, about trying to promote Albuquerque to get the workers to come when they open the office. And I just hope some of those innovative people will stay
exactly
here in Albuquerque.
No, I've heard, I think that that many of them are so invested in the state and they want to stay in Albuquerque in New Mexico. And I think that that's encouraging. I think with the way technology is today, working remotely is an opportunity. And so I think hopefully many of them will be able to stay here in the state.
And the technologies are just pervasive. Technologies, for the purposes of our discussion, we narrow it to media technologies or emerging media technologies. This isn't about nanotechnology or right. Until I'm looking forward to the time when there's a nano video recorder. Microscopic level on a little robot that
exactly.
But until that point, so the media, the emerging media technologies are what? The games?
We're working in immersive media, interactive media, gaming. And so those three seem to be pervasive in what we do. One of the tracks that I'm very interested in, and this comes back to my architectural background, is something we're calling cultural media. And so I've been working on a research project up in Dixon and Bootle area, and we're looking at the evolution of that culture and looking at through technology as a way of documenting and articulating. It's been an agrarian culture for centuries, and we're trying to create a database that allows people to understand that community and understand the evolution of that. So those things are, working with the historic preservation director at the University of New Mexico, and looking at how digital technologies can be a part of, archiving and promoting what we have here in the state is something that we're very interested in.
So this is like collecting oral histories and that sort of thing?
Oral histories, using things like Google Earth as a way of bringing historical maps, using the technology to allow an evolution to occur in terms of understanding the geographical specificity of that is really something that we're able to articulate in the database. And so it's images, historical images, videos. It's a very robust kind of repository of information.
Is there a particular reason you picked that area?
Well, it's been we've had a lot of connections in with that community. Some of our faculty are from that that area, so it was just a logical kind of connection. And really, you know, there's just the historical relationship to Spain was something that was really important to us, and so we wanted to dig into that community and really find out what we could do to assist it. And one of the things that we did was create an open source platform so that the community could to engage that community and develop that repository of information.
Terrific. We're coming up just about a minute left. And we had talked previously, too, about keeping kind of a track on the students and being able to tell where they're going after they graduate. Mm-hmm. You do that, you track them.
We try to keep close affiliations and ties with our graduates and really try to figure out where they're going, because it really helps us in terms of focusing the program. And so, you know, it's important to have those connections, and you know, with a field that's constantly moving, it's important to see where the trends are, and they define that trend for us.
Tim, I appreciate you being here today. It's been a wonderful conversation. Good luck to you and to the program, and I hope to get down there and get a tour of the facilities.
Definitely, you got to come down, and thank you very much for having me.
All right. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on KTRC Talk 1260, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. We're back with New Mexico Film Works. I'm your guest host this morning, filling in for Toby Ives. My name is Dirk Norris, and we're on Talk 1260 KTRC. And on the phone we have Don Gray, and Don's going to be talking about the a little more in-depth of the subject he covered last week, the seven deadly sins of locations. Hi, Don.
Hi, Dirk. How are you?
I'm great. And I just realized recently that about this time last year, you were taking the Locations 101 workshop on the road. You were in Ruidoso a year ago in May.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I was thinking this morning as I was thinking about how to go more in-depth on this, and it occurred to me really that I wanted to sort of reiterate that what I'm trying to do is kind of educate people about locations, because, you know, most independent, small, New Mexico-based, student-based films are shot on location as opposed to, you know, in a big studio where everything can be controlled. And the locations is a big part of it, and I've seen a lot of small productions, unfortunately, be kind of cratered by location issues. And that's really what I was hoping to sort of educate about and help people to avoid.
Terrific. So today you're covering the first one is Overreaching?
Right, exactly. And before I touch on that a little bit, mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, you know, I was going through my notes here, and I wanted to just offer up a quick list of the kinds of things that the location department is responsible for as we go through this list again. These are all of the things that you have to be aware of as a location person, or at least a good list of them. They do the initial scouting. They present the locations to the production. Then they have to secure contracts and permits for the locations. They have to deal with all of the logistics, things like road closures and barricades in the public, all of that on location. They create maps and signage to get the crew to the set every morning. They deal with crew access when the art department has to get in 2 weeks before and has to paint something. They're the ones that coordinate that. Any on-set requests that come up pertaining to the location while you're shooting have to be dealt with. They deal with security. They deal with police and fire. They're the liaisons for both the owner of the property and the public as well, and the production itself. And then they're responsible for wrap out. In other words, they have to get everybody out clean, everybody's happy, everything's been restored to the place that it was when they arrived in the first place. And so you want to keep those things in mind as you're looking at this list. So overreaching, as I thought about that some more, you know, I think some of that's a little bit obvious in that you could maybe think, well, I want to shoot on a military base. Well, that's a pretty big deal. That's kind of overreaching, and their chances are that you're probably not going to get that opportunity. Another way that you can overreach is actually by having too many locations in your script. And I see this even in, you know, multi-million-dollar independent features sometimes. Is every time an emotion in the script changes or a conversation changes, they set it in an entirely different location. The reason that can really get you in trouble is, the funny thing is, Dirk, you know, every time you have to move your company, you lose time. It takes time away from shooting your movie. So you want to make sure that if you're going to move your company, that it's for the best reason possible, which is to serve the story, and not just because you want a different location per se. So you have to be really careful about that, and that's one of those insidious overreaching things that you can do. The very first film I ever made, I had 10 locations that we shot in 4 days. And my next film, I had 2 locations.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a quick learning curve there.
Yes, because I realized we spent way too much time fussing around and moving from one place to another place, and I didn't get as much time to shoot my film as I wanted to shoot because we were moving.
I just read a 7-page script from a young fellow from Mescalero, and I think he had attended your workshop because he only had 2 locations in the script.
Great.
And you know, he's going, yeah, I don't want to have to move around a lot. I'm learning as I'm going, but keep things simple.
Exactly, and that, you know, that's a really important point, and it's one that I think people miss because, as I say, you know, people who are inexperienced at writing, they think that every time there's a tonal change or a different conversation takes place or, you know, another day appears, that that has to be an entirely different location, and it really doesn't. You really only want to do that if you absolutely need it from a storytelling standpoint.
Right, there's always the opportunity to change chairs around or lighting or just set up a room completely differently.
Yes, and it's a great point too, actually. You know, one of the things that I always encourage people to do is to be very open when you're writing, to write to your resources, but then to be very open to finding things that on your scout that could work for your story that are in close proximity to each other. Sometimes the outside can be one scene and the inside could be another. You know, one of my films had a restaurant and the exterior, some kind of exterior. And so I found the restaurant and then I chose the exterior that was right across the street because, again, I knew that meant I wouldn't have to move us around so many times.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, and the second one?
The second one is really obvious, I think, and we all lament this, of course, and that's no budget. Mm. And I don't mean to state the obvious, and actually what I want to say here is, look, we all know we're working with limited, sometimes no budgets, sometimes small budgets, but I think what drives me a little bit crazy as a location person is I think oftentimes whatever budget is created for small films or independent films, one of the departments that gets short shrift is oftentimes the location department. And as I said, it's a big department that has a lot of responsibility, and things can go wrong very quickly. And when they go wrong, that means you don't get to shoot your movie. So I think you have to have some kind of line item in your budget for location situations and needs. And in particular, I think it's really bad form to try to ingratiate yourself into somebody's home, somebody's business, somebody's office, without bearing something, whether it's just a small, gratuitous payment of some kind. Mm-hmm. I think that's at least says that we're trying, as opposed to trying to get everything for free and not really bringing anything. And again, we can also deal in non-cash currency, as I mentioned before. You know, if you're shooting in a bar, like I mentioned last week, and you need somebody to stand behind the bar and be the bartender, well, give that role to the owner of the bar. Let them be involved.
Right, but not necessarily saying we're going to put the name of your bar, you know, right up in our movie.
Well, and exactly, because I think a lot of people try that approach. They say, well, you know, this will be really great for your business because it'll be featured in our film. Look, many Hollywood films don't ever actually have a very long shelf life. And so the idea that somehow somebody's business is going to benefit from a small independent film that maybe goes to some film festivals, that's not really fair. And after a while, I think people start to get wise to that, and it makes it harder for the next person who comes along.
Right.
So that's why I think you should come bearing something. You know, I've actually offered PA jobs to the sons and daughters of location owners. You know, let them hang with us on set for a while and see what it's like to make a movie, and maybe that's something they'd like to do. So come offering something.
You've got to really be a little bit creative.
Yes, exactly.
So why do you think location gets overlooked in the budget?
Well, it's funny. I was talking this week with a location manager friend of mine, and you know, it's kind of an industry-wide thing that I think a lot of people underappreciate the location department and what they bring to the final product. Now, of course, all the departments are important, and everybody thinks their job is very important, and it's very true. But I have a feeling that, you know, it seems on the surface like a lot of logistics and maybe not quite as much of the kind of the interesting creative part of it. And so I think that's why people think, oh, well, you know, we'll deal with that later, or, you know, one of the producers can handle these problems or that sort of thing. And I also think people that haven't seen films made or have limited exposure to that don't quite understand the incredible magnitude of what goes on a film set, even a small film set.
Sure. I think that there is an illusion about movies just get made and they don't see all that work that's done in the background. And location, that's kind of like first in, last out, so it doesn't have that same visibility.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Can we go, did you have more to say about that? I have another question to ask you.
No, that's fine. I think we can finish that up and we'll do a couple more next week.
Okay, terrific. Then I wanted to briefly ask you, Toby has been talking about the AFCI location trade show that's coming up in June. Can you briefly mention what that's about?
Sure. That's a long-running trade show situation put on by the Association of Film Commissioners International. It's a big trade show. It takes place every year in Los Angeles. What it really is an opportunity for film commissions from around the country and around the world to get a little face-to-face time with people in the industry. So it's held this year. It's the first year it's going to be held at the Los Angeles Convention Center. For many years, it was actually in Santa Monica. So this year it'll be downtown Los Angeles. There are booths there from film commissions all around the country, and then producers, directors, filmmakers of all kinds of stripes will come to the convention center, and it's a good time to get to see a little bit of the locations you can offer. Most people have some kind of presentation about locations themselves, and then be able to discuss projects one-on-one, and really, I think more than anything, it's an opportunity to forge relationships with people in the industry and have them be interested in coming to New Mexico to make their film.
So you're going to be talking, and you're going this year?
Yes.
So you'll be talking to directors and producers, and they're going to be saying, we need a cafe set in the middle of nowhere. And you're going to say, I've got just what you need. Here are your options. Look at all these photographs.
Yes, exactly. And and then they'll want to know about logistical support and our crew base and our studio capability, all of those sorts of things. But really, it really has always been amazing to me since I got into the industry at how small and interpersonal the film industry is. Mm-hmm. Really quite small for such a large industry representing a lot of dollars. And so it really is an opportunity to just forge some bonds and get to know each other, see somebody's face that you've talked to on the phone.
Right, great. Don, I really appreciate it, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thanks, Dirk.
All right, thank you. You've been listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. And we're back with New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and we have John Armijo on the phone. And John, if I can ask you a quick question before we get started.
Sure.
This is kind of from left field, but last week you were talking about films that have been made by with various family members,
right?
Fathers and sons and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I'm guessing there's not a database where you can just say, okay, to do a search on fathers and sons and get something spit out. I'm guessing this is raw research or your encyclopedic knowledge of the films.
It's research we have on our database.
Okay. So you
can't search for it.
You can search for it.
You cannot.
Oh, you cannot. Okay. That's, yeah, all right. Yeah. So there's a lot of work involved in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Today you're talking about Western sets.
Correct. We're going to visit the sets in Santa Fe and Galisteo. And what sets them apart from a Hollywood set is that they are working ranches complete with all the accoutrements of a ranch and a plethora of locations like canyons, cliffs, rock formations, desertscapes, and what have you. And many films have used more than one ranch to tell their story. When Wyatt Earp filmed here in 1994, the Eves Ranch and the Tom Ford Ranch doubled for Dodge City, Tombstone, and Wichita, Kansas. And in 1989, Lonesome Dove used all three sets. A while back, the Western Writers of America unveiled their top 100 Western films of all time, and 14 of them were made in the Land of Enchantment. The first film made at Bonanza Creek was The Man from Laramie in 1955. It ranked number 14 on the top 100 list. Since then, 59 films have shot there. In 2011, Cowboys and Aliens not only added some pretty nifty sets, but they also blew up a whole bunch of them, those darn aliens.
Yeah.
One set that impressed a Texas historian was the reproduction of Austin, Texas, circa 1855 for the CBS miniseries Comanche Moon. What caught his eye was the Austin courthouse, which he said looked exactly like it did in 1855. The gentleman was so impressed that he called up Bonanza Creek and arranged a visit to the set. Kathy Smith, a longtime Santa Fe resident and Emmy Award winner for Son of the Morning Star, was the costume designer on Comanche Moon. Kathy was also responsible for costume construction on Dances with Wolves. Birgitta Berkey, a longtime resident of Pecos, was a costume supervisor on Kevin Costner's film. And in 2007, the controversial reality TV series Kid Nation took over the ranch. The first set built at Bonanza Creek was in 1981 for The Legend of the Lone Ranger. The J.W. Eaves Ranch has been the location for 49 productions. The first film made there was in 1968 for a non-Western called Where Angels Go, Trouble Follows. The NBC TV series Empire used the Eaves Ranch as its primary location for its TV ranch, the Garrett Ranch. They shot 13 episodes there and at Bonanza Creek. They went to Las Vegas, they went to Española, and they filmed at San Ildefonso Pueblo. This was the only TV series in the 1962 fall schedule filmed in color and on location. The first set built at the Eaves Ranch was for the Cheyenne Social Club in 1969. This ranked number 64 on the top 10 list, top 100 list. The film starred Henry Fonda and James Stewart, Shirley Jones, and Sue Ann Langdon, and it was directed by Gene Kelly. In 1982, the producers of the sci-fi adventure film Time Rider, The Adventure of Lyle Swan, constructed on the East Ranch as realistic a Mexican village as you'll ever see. Unfortunately, it's no longer standing, so you'll have to rent the film. Albuquerque native and location manager Alan Swain was the extras casting director, and Birgitta Berkey was a PA on Time Rider. It's interesting where it all begins for us, isn't it? On another tidbit, Swain's mother, Jeannie Swain, was Albuquerque's first film commissioner, and she produced the first print directory for the state film office that was hand-typed and mimeographed, and we still have a copy of it. Two John Wayne films, The Cowboys, ranked number 21 on the top 100 list, and Chisholm, ranked 71, also shot at Eaves, as did the 96th-ranked film, The Culpeper Cattle Company. The Tom Ford Ranch has been the location destination for 36 films. Last year, the action fantasy blockbuster Thor turned the Western set into a modern-day city complete with sidewalks, parking meters, and everything one associates with an urban setting. Then after they finished, they tore it all down and restored it to its natural 1860s habitat. Like Bonanza Creek, the first film made at the ranch was The Man from Laramie. And the first set built at the Ford Ranch was for Silverado, rated number 35 on the top 100 list. not only was this a great Western, but it had one of the best casts ever assembled. Too many to mention here, but one of them was Sheb Woolley, who had a hit record in 1958 for the Purple People Eaters. Remember that song, Dirk?
I do remember
that
song.
There you go. It was a long-haired, one-eyed purple people eater.
Yeah, right.
And in 1995, a Japanese production company took over the ranch to produce a samurai Western comedy called East Meets West. The film was written and directed by the acclaimed director Kihachi Okamoto, who filled his cast with some of Japan's most popular actors. Taos resident and first-time actor Angelique Rome had a leading role in the film and played the heroine. Kihachi's wife, Miniko, not only co-financed the film, but she also prepared Japanese cuisine for the cast and crew. Dirk, here's a game that I play with Toby every week.
Yeah, I was afraid
it's
of this.
It's time to play name the cowboy's horse.
Okay, make it easy.
The Cisco Kid.
Diablo.
There you go. Way to go. Okay. Now,
let me ask you one.
Sure.
Tonto's horse.
Scout.
All right.
And what was the name of Pancho's horse?
Oh, I got no idea.
Loco.
Loco.
Well, there you go, Dirk.
John, thank you so very much for, I don't think people have any clue as to how much movie stuff has been done in New Mexico. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
We've been talking with John Armijo, and we're just about ready to wrap things up here. You've been listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC. You can go to the New Mexico Film website at nmfilm.com. Tons of information there. And just a reminder to, if you're a grip, if you're a gaffer, if you're a producer or a director, you can register on the directory that the film office has for free. Just another way of getting your name out there. New Mexico Film Office is also on Facebook, and I imagine they're going to have a Twitter at some point. So lots of ways to get in touch with the New Mexico Film Office. And as Don said, they're going to be out there in California trying to bring more films to New Mexico so that more of you can go to work. So New Mexico Film Office is working for you guys. It's been a great pleasure being here. Gino scowls at me because I wanted to play with all the dials and switches, but he admonished me to just talk into the microphone. So thank you very much.